You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 23rd to the 29th of January 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporter Jack Grove, books editor Karen Shook and deputy news editor John Morgan. UCAS figures on student acceptances are always cause for, well, either celebration or panic within universities. The latest data is out today and are the subject of our main lead news story. We'll hear a bit more on that in a second. Our ever-popular book section this week features a biography of Walter Benjamin and the latest from literary critic Frederick Jameson. We'll hear a bit more about that soon. And Vice-Chancellor's pay levels always provoke much discussion, nay anger, and we'll bring news of one VC who accepted a £105,000 pay rise at the same time as the UCU prepares for a series of strikes over a 1% pay offer. That's a little later in the episode. First, though, student numbers. John, what are the headlines from the latest, today's UCAS data on student acceptances?
So these figures show us which universities have won or lost in the first two years of the new system. So they're figures on 2013 student acceptances. You compare those with 2011 and you can see how universities have fared since fees rose to £9,000 and student number controls were partially relaxed. Mm-hmm. So the biggest winners were Aston, UCL, Bristol and Exeter, which all increased their numbers of students entering by 35% or more compared with 2011. And the biggest losers were London Mets, Bedfordshire, Bolton, UEL and Liverpool Hope University, which all saw their number of students entering drop by more than 20% compared with 2011.
That's a big concern. I mean, cut to the chase. What's the financial impact of these figures?
Well, you could say that these UCAS figures are almost like what the grant allocation used to be, whereas in the past it was HEFC or whichever funding council in the nations would dole out the money to institutions and they'd eagerly await this every year. Mm. Now it's the student numbers that are key, and under the more marketised system where there's less role for government in allocating places and it's more about competition, it's all about how many students each university can attract. These rises and falls are worth tens of millions of pounds in gained or lost income to universities, so it's absolutely crucial. And the winners have really been working the AAB and ABB system very hard. It's the kind of more selective institutions have been able to expand, and the reason possibly why we see post-1992 universities among the biggest losers is because to create the AAB and ABB places, every institution had to have its student number control sliced off a portion. But it's the post-1992 universities who don't recruit lots of high-grade students who can't win those numbers back. So they've really been more likely to fare, to find things more tough under the new system.
Mm. It's also a bit of a worry for those who are recruiting quite strongly because, as you say in your piece, if you're recruiting an extra 30% extra students, do you have the infrastructure to accommodate them? Do you have the classrooms, the laboratories, even the sort of halls of residence? That those take several years to be built, and you know, we've heard of cases where students are staying in travel lodges and sort of temporary accommodation because there aren't the rooms available for them. So, you know, is it necessarily a good thing for them to recruit more?
Mm, definitely. There have been problems at Bristol, haven't there, with finding accommodation for the extra students under the AAB expansion. And that's the point that Nick Hillman, the director of the Higher Education Policy Institute, makes in the article, which is if popular universities expand really quickly, the student experience could suffer. And that's quite interesting coming from Nick, given that he was special advisor to David Willetts and pretty closely involved in the development of this new system.
Yeah, indeed. And we'll be quoting him a lot now in his new role at HEFI. I wonder how long we'll need to point out his role in that system for. But a great reader this week, page 6 for that one. Now, last week we had an extra podcast for you, a books podcast featuring Trevor Cox, Professor of Acoustic Engineering at the University of Salford and author of last week's Book of the Week. It's still available. Do go online and listen to it. But that was last week. This is this week. Karen, what's in the books section for us this week?
Well, at the back of the book section, we have a review of Linda Colley's new book, Acts of Union and Disunion, What Has Held the UK Together and What Is Dividing It. Linda Colley is presently hosting a 15-part BBC radio programme on this very issue. She's now at Princeton, eminent UK academic, much admired by Tony Blair and many others. She considers the fact that the united period of the United Kingdom is actually quite a short period of time and looks at the stresses that are involved ahead of the Scottish referendum later this year. As a Canadian, of course, the word referendum always makes my blood run cold. We suffered through a number of them with Quebec over the years, so it'll be interesting to see how it transpires here. Also in this week's issue, we have a review by Rula Al Abdulrazak at the University of East London, who is a branding strategist specifically with regard to nations, and she's considering a book in her field, Branding the Nation, the Global Business of National Identity. Of course, this is something that people see at a university level, but also at a state level. And Rula points out that Muammar Gaddafi had 2 years of success in branding Libya with top-flight British consultants. Unfortunately, that didn't actually prevent the uprising that brought down his regime.
It certainly did.
Also this week, Peter Gwynne, an eminent historian of the Tudor period, reviews Writing Faith and Telling Tales, Literature, Politics and Religion in the work of Thomas More, which is written by Thomas Betteridge, who's an equally eminent scholar, but he's a professor of theatre. And I have to say that Peter warmed my heart by beginning this review on a subject very well known to him by saying, "Much of Thomas Betteridge's book remains a mystery to me." So I didn't realise that even academics could admit that people outside their tribe often shaped books and discussions in ways that were completely opaque to others.
Reassuring.
Also this week, Robert Eaglestone is reviewing, as you mentioned, Chris, the new book from Frederick Jameson, The Antinomies of Realism. I always have to struggle to make sure I don't say antimony. Eaglestone says, Jameson being so famous, people know what he's going to say before he says it. And his work is so widely taught that, of course, everyone feels they have to deal with it, even if some people think they should have a go. He also says that his quirky stylistic turns are a lot like hipsters writing about pixies or Arctic monkeys for Rolling Stone, dropping the definite articles. And he's also fond of making pronouncements like who America's greatest novelist is, or that Zola is the Wagner of 19th century criticism.
I'm looking at page here, though. It's in our news style, it's he told Times Higher Education rather than the Times Higher Education.
Well,
are we hipsters as well?
I think maybe we are. Of course, the definite article is our name. So.
True.
And this week's book of the week, Walter Benjamin, A Critical Life. This is a major work from Howard Island and Michael Jennings, two American scholars who have worked on the seemingly endless projects of collecting Walter Benjamin's work. Walter Benjamin, the academic who committed suicide in Porbu, Spain in 1940, fearing that he would not be allowed out of Europe. His passport had been revoked by the Nazis. Famous for many things, inventing the concept of the flâneur, much beloved of cultural studies theorists, writing an awful lot of stuff, and apparently quite hapless as an aspirant academic, as our reviewer Joanna Hodge at Manchester Metropolitan points out. He was an aspirant academic, but naively supposed his contempt for actual academics to be undetectable. This book is Benjamin Warts and All, talks about his attempts to secure places at institutions around Europe, not doing too well, being interested in gambling and equally interested in living off his parents' savings, the earnings of his wife, and the charity of friends and admirers. So we see the downside of Benjamin, but we also, of course, see many of the things that make him the great figure of 20th century criticism that he is.
Mm-hmm. All of that kicks off on page 48 in this week's magazine. Do take a look. Moving a bit further forward in the magazine, page 8, the headline, Jack, reads £105,000 rise for head as staff denied living wage. What's this story about? It's obviously about VC pay, but you can reveal who it was I alluded to at the start of the show.
Yeah, this is the pay package of Sir Keith Burnett, the Vice-Chancellor of Sheffield University, and he's been awarded this pay rise this year, which is the largest we've seen so far in the sector. It's a 39% pay rise, and when you include the total pay package, it's 29%. Given this story is coming out on the same day that lots of UCU members are holding a strike over a 1% pay offer, which follows four successive below inflation rises, you can obviously see there's going to be a bit of anger about this. And we're not... Well, this is interesting for several reasons as well, because Sir Keith, it's the largest in the sector, but it came in the same year that he also resisted calls for the introduction of the living wage for staff at Sheffield University. He also set up a subsidiary company which was specifically designed to lower staffing costs, and so staff at this new company owned by Sheffield University wouldn't receive the same terms and conditions as staff directly employed by Sheffield. Unions are very unhappy about that.
So he's created his own outsourcing opportunities.
Exactly. It's now sort of privatising, but within the university, sort of insourcing, it's called.
Right.
And we're not just picking on Sir Keith, though. I've been looking at all the information on VC pay coming in over throughout the whole sector, and I was revisiting the pay given to the Russell Group vice-chancellors, and overall, the average salary for a Russell Group vice-chancellor is now just under £300,000. That was a 7.7% increase on the previous year, and if you just look at the universities in England within the Russell Group, it's a 9.5% increase in salary in the same year that £9,000 tuition fees came in. So there's a feeling that pay at the top is going through the roof, while at the bottom and for rank and file staff, it's falling behind inflation every year and people are taking a real terms pay cut.
Indeed. No, it's an important story and one that we will revisit, no doubt, throughout the year. That's all for this week's issue review. If you think we're a bit shorter than usual, don't worry, we have a second podcast for you out this week. It's my interview with Professor Sir Peter Gregson, who's the Cranfield Vice-Chancellor. You can get that in the same place as you got this one, both on our website and on iTunes. I should also mention, just before I go, our cover feature this week, which looks at the winners and losers in Australia's experiment with uncapped student numbers. Obviously, the UK about to follow the same path, so interesting lessons in that one. But that's all for this week's issue review. You can join the conversation with us on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Facebook. Just search for us on all of those platforms. But until next week, that's all for now.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.